Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Coming up later this hour, the NYPD infiltrated political groups suspected of no wrongdoing before the Republican convention in 2004. We'll find out what that's all about and some documents just coming to light in the New York Times and why the NYPD does not want those documents unsealed for the rest of us to see. But first, what has Miles Davis got in common with Mao Zedong? What has Leon Trotsky got to do with Dick Cavett? Well, they share equal billing in a new book by the writer Clive James. The Australian-born James, who lives in London, draws on his many years as a critic and journalist in Britain to look at the shared traits of figures who dominated politics and the arts in the 20th century. In his book Cultural Amnesia, Necessary Memories from History and the Arts, James looks at the legacy of totalitarianism on our culture, primarily. He says some of the dictators of the last 100 years spurned creativity as they reduced the complexity of human life to simplistic ideologies. And while he says the days of totalitarian states may be over, the ideology survives without borders, and he says we need a new humanism for liberal democracy to survive. Clive James, big thoughts. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, I'm extremely honored to be here. That was a wonderful introduction. It's better than anything I can say. Are you sure you don't want to go on with it?
No, we can end it right there. Right. That really does.
Get on to the NYPD, what they have.
But this is a long book, and there's so much in here. It's built around insights you have into some of the cultural and political figures of the last century. Mao, I mentioned, Kafka, de Gaulle, Margaret Thatcher, Duke Ellington. You don't see a lot of Margaret Thatcher, Duke Ellington books.
You don't see a lot of books, that, as you said, that put Mao Zedong and Miles Davis together. And what do they have in common? They both played trumpet to about the same standard, in my opinion. But that gets me into real trouble with the Miles Davis fans. The book is not afraid to be provocative and sometimes, you might say, insane. But it's my opinions. And to me, what connects all these people, they're in my head, and I think it's the way the mind works. Is when you look at the furniture of your brain to the extent that you can, it's just full of people and achievements and quotations and their contests and arguments. And some people say silly things and some people say wise ones. And I try to build the book out of things that I'd remembered written or remembered hearing said. And I could go on a long time about this book, but the book is actually here, and now it's enormous. And the first thing I can say about it is don't drop it on your foot. It's 800 pages thick, and reading it may or may not improve your mind, but dropping it is bound to impair your walking ability.
Yes, well, you are over 800 pages long here. And did I hear that it took you 40 years to write?
I took 40 years to think of it and get ready for it, and about 4 years to do the actual writing. I spent about excuse me for a second, I've got jet lag cough here. I only just flew in. I spent about 40 years making notes for it. I knew I was going to write it one day. And then about 4 years actually doing it. And well, it really sprang from bits that I underlined in books. You know, you do that thing where you write in the margin and then you start writing in the end papers. And the book gradually becomes unsaleable secondhand. And I knew one day I would write it. But it did take a long time, yeah.
So at the risk of reducing complexity to a simplistic formula, I think your basic thrust here is that the past 100 years or so show the danger of reducing complexity to simple formulas.
Oh, yes.
So can you talk about this and explain how it informed the ideologies of Hitler and Stalin and what that had to do with the arts?
Well, there's an appeal to totalitarian ideology. That's the only way of explaining how popular it could be when it was successful. Sometimes it didn't even need fear in order to take up its position, especially early on. It would work by a general consent, and I think the appeal that ideology makes is that it simplifies the complexity of society, and since a free society is inherently complex, and a free society is inherently full of things that you don't like, things that you fear, an ideology has this attraction of saying, well, It's all that needn't scare you anymore. You can just sort of put your feet up and go to sleep. It has this intoxicating appeal, and I try to bring that into the book. In other words, I try to take the totalitarian ideologies at their own estimation. And, of course, the paradox, the sinister paradox, is that a lot of intellectuals did exactly that. They did take the ideologies at their own estimation. Nazi ideology, fascist ideology, was never that popular among the intellectuals in the free world. But communist totalitarianism was indeed. In fact, we're still suffering from the consequences. What we call the left intellectuals in almost all the free countries were very slow to give up their investment in the Soviet Union, and they would transfer the investment to China and so on, and transfer it forever, always seeking for some dream world which is not like the one we are actually living in.
And so another central idea of the book, a related one, is about the need for humanism. For the purposes of clarity, what do you mean by humanism?
Well, that's the hardest thing to be clear about. I don't think it's just being preoccupied with Greek and Latin and a lot of established texts. I've got a feeling that humanism is broader than that, that it entails the love that we feel for various activities. Love is a big word in my vocabulary. But I love literature, and I love jazz, and I love classical music, and I love painting, and I love the art, sports, very slowly throughout my life began to occur to me that it was the thing that connected all these things. It was this general variety of creativity was what humanism consisted of. The appreciation of that, the appreciation of these connections, the appreciation of the creativity that creates complexity in the world. And there'll always be a tendency to reduce that complexity in the name of safety. And I think we have to resist it. And that's why I call the book Cultural Amnesia, because you tend to forget everything that threatened this complexity. We tend to take liberal democracy for granted, and we can't. It was built in response, over centuries, it was built in response to a deadly human tendency to simplify everything to the extent that you don't have to do anything except obey, that you only need three or four principles to live on. You only need to love five or six things. And this tendency must always be resisted, and democracy resists it. But it does so at the cost of introducing a variety into life that we find bewildering.
Clive James, author now of Cultural Amnesia, Necessary Memories from History and the Arts. We can take your phone calls for him. Maybe you know this book. This book is being talked about a lot in all kinds of circles. Maybe you want to ask him a question about one of the figures he writes about in the book, from Dick Cavett to Miles Davis on out, even John Kerry. We'll get to that. But 212-433-WNYC is our phone number, 212-433-9692 for Clive James, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. Well, thankfully, the dictatorships that you write about are a thing of the past. Most of them, there's North Korea and a few others, but you write that totalitarianism itself is not over. In fact, it may even be more of a threat because it's not hemmed in by borders, your words. Are you talking about Al-Qaeda ideology and things like that?
Well, yes, the threat of extremist religion. And I hasten to say that the real threat of extremist religion is directed at moderate religion. And that is never said often enough, in my view. When you take the question of Islam, for example, the reason I don't like this idea of calling Islamic extremism Islamist is that people get confused and think you're talking about Islam. No, not at all. The vast body of Islam, moderate Islam throughout the world, is a religion like any other, and we hope it will speak up against its own extremists. But the threat, it comes from the extremists, and it comes against Islam itself before it even threatens us. But yes, of course, extremist religion has always been an ideological nightmare. It has been in our religions. My own religion, Presbyterianism, is no longer a threat to mankind, I'm glad to say. But it was. It was only 500 years ago, and that's not long in historic terms, when people like John Calvin would drown their opponents in Lake Geneva. The absolute religion is always a threat, and that's totalitarianism. You could even say that the Nazis and the Soviet communists were a totalitarian religion without the religion. That was where the thing began to purify itself, began to separate. So the totalitarianism became a whole way of thought. But yes, it's always going to be there.
Melody in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Clive James. Hi, Melody.
Hi. It's great to hear your show and be on it. And I want to thank Clive for showing that the intellect and the intellectual doesn't mean an absence of wit. It's wonderful listening to you.
I wish I was being wittier today. I'm not doing a very good job of saying what's in my book. My book does that.
The problem with
writing one of these things is you can't do it better, so all you can say is, buy my book, and be careful how you hold it. It's big.
I'm waiting for the Coles notes.
Well, it is the Coles notes. It's funny you should say that.
The what?
The Coles notes. I think what you're saying is the little book of notes that may help you pass the exam.
Right.
In some ways, the book is that. You know,
it's
actually aimed at college students.
If you're getting the whole 20th century of culture and politics into 800 pages,
that's
I guess that is the Coles notes.
It's a start, yeah.
Well, my question for you is, it's a statement and then a question. In the first election, when Bush was running and PBS was looking at the unclaimed voter, after one of the debates, a woman said that she decided that she was going to vote for Bush, and the announcer asked why that was, and she said, well, he makes it all so simple.
Ah, yes.
And I think that was always one of my great concerns about why this regime keeps winning, is they have got a grasp on the simplicity that sometimes the Democrats lack in sending out their message. So I just wanted to hear your comment on that.
Well, the question you're raising is really between the American voters and each other, and I'm told that they... Last time they chose Bush by a hair's breadth, the breadth of a chaff or a chad. What was it? It was a little...
Well, it was a chad in 2000 and maybe a hair in 2004.
Yeah, well, it's really up to the American voters, and I'm a visitor. But yes, I've got a feeling that...
I could take calls like this for an hour. People who are going to say, if your concern is that totalitarianism reduces complexity to simplistic formulas, that's exactly what American right-wing neoconservative does, neoconservatism does, and that's exactly what Bush does. Do you want to go there or not? Because it's basically a free society.
I don't want to spend long there because democracy worked and a choice was made, and now you're stuck with it, and you've got a chance to reverse it.
This is a
much bigger thing than I made it sound. Can I just interrupt you? I know I'm buffaloing you here, but there is a chance to reverse it, and that's what's different between democracy and totalitarianism. Because in a totalitarian state, you don't get a chance to reverse it.
Alan in Suffolk County, you're on WNYC with Clive James. Hello, Alan.
Hello, how are you?
All right.
Listening to the author, I was intrigued because it sounds like a lot of his ideas come from Ari Bergson in the sense that, you know, when you're pushing for social cohesion, you do want to tend to step on complexity because it's a lot easier to deal with everybody in lockstep.
Well, it's not only true, it's dreadfully true. But it's not really a danger in a liberal democracy properly constituted. And there's a minimal definition of democracy, which was reached by Karl Popper when he was an exile in New Zealand during World War II. He wrote The Open Society and Its Enemies. And he also reached a minimum definition of democracy, which is very useful. And he said that democracy exists so that an oligarchy cannot rule. In other words, the government can always be changed by the whim of the people. And notice he said the whim of the people. He didn't say you have to have an informed electorate. It didn't depend on that. It was just the electorate could exercise its whim, that would be enough, and the oligarchy could not set up a permanent rule. And that minimum definition of democracy is extremely useful.
Critic and journalist Clive James, my guest on WNYC. His latest book is Cultural Amnesia, Necessary Memories from History and the Arts. We'll continue in a minute with Clive James. More of your calls to 212-433-WNYC or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. And we'll ask him why, when he writes about intellectual and creative giants of the 20th century, he did not include Albert Einstein, but he did include his cousin, Alfred Einstein. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Clive James, author of Cultural Amnesia, Necessary Memories from History and the Arts. And as I said before the break, you do not include Albert Einstein in your book, but you do include his cousin, the musicologist Alfred Einstein. Also, you include Hitler when writing about totalitarianism, but you don't write about Stalin. How did you figure out who to include and exclude?
Well, I wasn't including the who so much as the what they said. And the book really started from things I'd underlined, which are usually quotations from writers or various political figures. And I started each essay from there, so it's not so much from the person, although you'll find that all these people get into the book. Like Einstein the physicist is all over the book. He keeps popping up. He pops up in an article about Charlie Chaplin, because Einstein and Chaplin once went to the premiere together of one of Chaplin's movies, City Lights, and Chaplin said this famous thing. He said, "I'm famous because everyone understands me, and you're famous because nobody understands you," which is actually a crucial comment about the nature of science and its relation to the rest of culture. So I started off writing an essay about that. But the musicologist Einstein, I'm getting my Alberts and Alfreds mixed up here. Alfred is in there because he said this wonderful thing about Mozart and Schubert. He said you have to imagine, the task is not to imagine what Mozart might have done if he'd lived as long as Beethoven. You have to imagine what he would have done if he'd lived as long as Schubert. What he's really saying is that Mozart died when he was 36, Schubert died when he was 31. If Schubert had been given 5 more years, what might he not have done? It's a fascinating topic. It raises the whole question of maturity in the arts and where genius comes from, when it could be so marked among those who die young, like Masaccio, the painter, was only 26. Büchner was only 26. And Bellini, I think, was only 31. And your listeners will know these things and come flooding in with phone calls to correct my dating, but the truth is that the whole question of talent dying young raises the question of what talent is and what it needs in order to mature, and so on. So I could write a long essay about it. And what this book essentially is a collection of essays that spring from quotations, sayings that I underline. It's not really an attempt to treat each famous historic person as a separate entity. I do have an essay on Mao. I do have an essay on Hitler. As far as I remember, I don't have an essay on Stalin. But Stalin is all over the book. Stalin affected the 20th century in every way, and especially in the arts. The art that didn't happen in the Soviet Union, there's an essay in that. There's a great, vast amount that didn't occur in Russia in the 20th century because of Stalinism. So you have to, from that you get a concept of history. It might have been different. Suppose there had been no revolution. Russia would have dominated the world.
And yet, in some parts of the Soviet bloc, creativity was allowed to continue to varying degrees. In fact, we saw in Czechoslovakia, for example, it was the playwright Václav Havel,
yes,
who finally helped lead his country out of that wilderness.
Well, Havel was allowed to live. It didn't really go much beyond that. And he had his little theater in Prague, the Little Lantern. I've been there, and I met Havel, and I very, very much admire him. But don't forget that the state persecuted him. And the typical act of the state towards Havel was to cut off the electricity, make his life impossible, and cut off the plumbing so that his house became uninhabitable. That was the relationship of the state to Havel, and that was a comparatively benevolent example of what the Soviet and Soviet bloc states did to their artists. So when you say that creativity was allowed, you've got to put a big qualifying mark against it. Now, to what extent was Shostakovich allowed to compose what he wanted? Well, the dreadful fate of Shostakovich is that Stalin actually took an interest in his work, which meant that Stalin tried to dictate his work. And Akhmatova, who the book starts with Akhmatova, the great Russian poet, she effectively did not function as a poet. The whole history of the Soviet Union, she effectively wasn't allowed to function as a poet at all. And she wrote this great poem in private called Requiem, which is a poem about her, I can quote it now, father dead, son in jail, pray for me. And Isaiah Berlin once said that poem would never be published in the Soviet Union while the Soviet Union was still there, and that was true. And one of the first things that happened when the Soviet Union wasn't there was that poem was published. You wouldn't say that was the power of art. You would just say that it was its capacity to endure. You see, I raise these questions, and I hope that some of the people who read the book, if they're encountering these questions for the first time, will be steered down various corridors to where there is more about this matter to be discovered. But maybe there is no final answer to some of it.
Dave in Westchester. You're on WNYC with Clive James. Hi, Dave.
Yes, hi, Clive. I'm sorry about the bad connection. I wanted to ask a real quick question. obviously, I haven't had the chance to read your 800-page book during the drive.
Dave, I'll try and give it a quick answer. I haven't been very good at quick answers today, but I'm working on them. Tell me your quick question.
So here's the quick question. Would you consider that maybe some of the greatest artists, especially and including Miles Davis, could be also considered to be totalitarian and would not be as successful had they allowed the kind of creativity that I seem to be hearing in this call or in your discussion? That in fact, a great artist, a great band leader, by necessity, in order to complete his vision, needs totalitarian.
No, he needs authority, which Duke Ellington have. I think I call any musician totalitarian, with the possible exception of John Coltrane, and I'm ready to take calls on that. But what he needs is authority, and a great artist will always have authority, and sometimes even intolerance. But Stravinsky was a very good example of that, and he crops up throughout the book. Stravinsky was never really ready to forgive any other musician for having talent. He was pretty long time reconciling himself to Beethoven. It was only in his last years of his life that Stravinsky wrote articles in favor of Beethoven's late quartets. It's quite common for artists to be extremely impatient about any praise given to any other artist in any other field, but that doesn't make them totalitarians. That simply means they're trying to express their vision. They don't set off to actually silence other artists. That's very, very rare. But you have to have authority. Ellington could never run his band without authority. And every one of the sidemen in Ellington's band who started their own bands, they all failed because they weren't band leaders. It's quite an art to marshal all those people.
Clive James, my guest on WNYC, author of Cultural Amnesia, Necessary Memories from History and the Arts. Here's an email that asks, doesn't free society contain its own ideologies, e.g. free market is a big ideology?
Yeah. That's a very deep and penetrating point, and I do not believe in the free market as an ideology. I don't think the free market has a mind. I think it's a necessary tool. I don't think there's such a thing as a liberal democracy without a free market, or can't be for long, but that doesn't mean the free market has a mind of its own. And I think the government needs a brain in order to control the free market's energy. But yes, there are ideologies within a free society. In fact, it consists of almost entirely of various brainwaves and bees in bonnets. And that's, for me, the scary aspect of liberal democracy, which I endorse thoroughly. And one of the reasons for this book exists is to put any doubt, any question of that beyond doubt. Liberal democracy is a desirable thing, a desirable end, something you must have. But it will always scare you. And it finds it very hard to control within itself destructive impulses. This same problem obsessed Lincoln. If you look at that in Lincoln's tomb in Washington, there's an extract from one of his serenades up there carved in the marble, which is really doubting whether any society which is free will be strong enough to protect itself. And he's put his finger right on the hot spot. How do you tolerate intolerance, for example? We're living with that question right now, and we're likely to go on living with it. And it's all in this book, because it all cropped up in the 20th century. There are places in the book where it shows you that it cropped up in the reign of Domitian. Tacitus dealt with some of these problems when he talked about Tiberius. And Montesquieu talked about it in 18th century France. But in the 20th century, everybody talks about it. Everybody is dealing with the problems that freedom raises. But one of the problems that freedom raises is that there will always be a temptation, especially among the intellectuals, strangely enough, especially among the people who are paid to think, to give their faith to some alternative, as if there was a totalitarian alternative in which you could relax, in which the problems would be over, that mankind would finally arrive at its desirable and desired state without any further mental effort, and it's just not so.
We were talking about money a minute ago, and your essay about Miles Davis looks at the invulnerability conferred on him by his wealth. And the quote you use is, if they don't like, Miles said, if they don't like what I write, I get into my Ferrari and I drive away.
Isn't it wonderful? And you know, I don't know where he said it. I heard it from a jazz man. That's one of the few quotes in the book that does not come from the printed page. I heard it from a jazz saxophonist who told me that's what Miles Davis once said.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing from the standpoint of creativity?
Oh, absolutely. You must have money. If you don't control your career will control you. You've got to keep the money. Every artist should have written over his desk or door, put it in the bank and leave it there until you know exactly what, what you're going to do with it. Otherwise, it will take over. There's nothing worse for an artist than to be in debt and to owe the company something. It's the story of black musicians in the 20th century in America, is they were robbed. And it's one of the reasons why bebop happened after World War II. It was a sociological move, a political gesture, an attempt to regain control. And I understand the impulse completely, and it's one of the things I try to treat in this book. That's the influence of politics and economics on the arts. It goes right to the heart of creativity, because unless you're free, and you have to be free, you have to be free economically, then you are not at liberty to create what you want.
Ed in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Clive James. Hi, Ed.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me on. I just want to point out, in a sense, there's an elephant in the room. The so-called liberal democracy is really not a democracy at all. What we live under is a dictatorship of the rich.
Yes.
The inequality that exists.
Can I just interrupt you there?
is growing.
Ed, hang on a second. You'll get to come back, but we'll have a conversation here. Clive, you wanted to say?
You're not being dictated to by the rich. If you were living under Louis XIV, you'd be dictated to by the rich. But the elephant in the room is not an elephant, and it's not a mouse either, but it's a much more controllable animal. I think the picture that you're painting, that it's not really a democracy, that is the kind of picture that a totalitarian mentality will always try to paint for you and say, no, your so-called democratic rights aren't rights at all. Your democratic privileges aren't privileges. Your choices aren't choices. Everything has been dictated to you, and it's simply not so.
Ed,
it won't be true for you today.
Ed, go ahead.
Well, we're in disagreement. The other point I wanted to make is that the diversity that this liberal democracy promotes is actually in many of the diverse cultures around the world, they're being compromised or threatened because of what people have called the Walmartization, the exportation of our economic culture.
Yeah, I don't quite buy the idea that American cultural imperialism, which I think is what you're talking about when you talk about Walmart and all the franchises and products that come out of the States and dominate the world, globalization, in fact. I don't think it's as quite as irresistible as all that. I come from Australia, and Australia does a fairly good job of maintaining its unique culture, along with all the things about America that it likes. If you've ever had, I don't know if you've got children, but if you've been left in charge of them for a whole week, by Thursday you'll be in McDonald's.
Ed, thank you for your call. A few things real quick. Dick Cavett, your essay about Dick Cavett describes him as one of the most original small screen talents, but you say his style did not suit an American mass audience.
Well, I think I may be oversimplifying, which is always a danger, but I did think he tried to operate in between seriousness and entertainment, and that's quite difficult in the States. Because America is a market culture in the sense that the label says what's in the can. And putting two labels on a can is always confusing. if not confusing to the audience, then it's confusing to the people who do the marketing. So I think people had a lot of trouble placing Cavett. And I think the people who actually employed him, to them he was always a problem. But that was exactly what I liked about him. We tend to say, those of us who work in Europe, that Europe is more subtle in that way. Maybe we just simply have less economic sense, less driving force. But it is seem to be startlingly true of America, the society which likes to classify things, where it is not really understood if the tone of voice is stretched between two imperatives. Cavett had two things that he could do. He could be very, very serious, talk about very, very serious topics, and he could do it in a very funny way. And that's wit, and that interests me. And it's not all that common on American television. And if people like Jon Stewart come along, they tend to get put in one category, and it'll actually be called that. I think it's called a comedy channel, am I right?
Yes, it is.
Well, you see, that's a very American phenomenon. And the idea that all the comedy should be in one place.
You mentioned that John Kerry had to pretend not to speak French when he ran for president.
That was conspicuously true, I thought. That told you, well, sometimes what doesn't happen tells you something. And Kerry was encouraged to suppress the fact that he actually could speak French. Now, why was that? Because I have a theory, for what it's worth, about the presidency and language. I think the existence of President Bush is enough to prove that it's too early in America's history to have a president for whom English is not his first language. On the other hand, when you get to Kerry, you get... I thought there were points to be gained by... There could have been gained by presenting him as a more sophisticated person. It was designed... It was decided by his handlers that the fact that he could speak French should be suppressed. Why? Because it would threaten whom exactly?
We're almost out of time with Clive James, author of Cultural Amnesia, Necessary Memories from History and the Arts. And here's an email that says, sounds like liberty and cultural freedom lay only in the hands of men, as I haven't heard mention of one woman's name. Subject line,
yes.
Feminine cultural amnesia?
You're wrong, because you heard the name Akhmatova, and Anna Akhmatova was certainly a woman. In fact, she was the woman of Russian poetry early in the 20th century, and all the poets loved her, and probably the main reason why Stalin couldn't kill her was that she was so highly regarded. But it is true that the men outnumber the women in this book, but the women are there, and it's dedicated to three women. It's dedicated to Aung San Suu Kyi of Burma, to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and to Ingrid Betancourt, who disappeared in South America last year, or the year before last, and to Sophie Scholl, who was the martyr of the White Rose Resistance Group in Munich in 1943. So there are women in the book, all right, but there are not that many of them compared to men, and I'm afraid it's a book about a man's world and the 20th century, and it taught a lot of us men to wish that women had made it instead.
Before you go, since you're Australian and such a big fan of liberal democracy, as you may know, today the first Guantanamo Bay captive to appear before the newly constituted military commission is having a trial. He is Australian. This is a really big news story in Australia right now, much bigger than here.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you have any thoughts on the implications of Gitmo for the liberal democracy that you've been defending to some of our callers here today.
You save your biggest question to last, and we'll never get it done. And I don't think freedom should be suspended to fight terrorism. My own view is that terrorists, it's probably a waste of time interrogating most of them. What they should be, threatened with is luxury, all the things they're said to fear. They should be threatened with that. That's my brief opinion. That my opinion on torture is that it's out. And I don't just think that. Montesquieu thought that, and it's in the book about why he said thought so, and it's in the book about why I agree with him. All that being said, I think is the Australian prisoner David Hicks by any chance? Is that his name?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you've got to remember that David Hicks was a pretty thoroughgoing opponent of what we would regard as liberal democracy, in the sense that I don't really want to.
The punishment for that is not torture, though, right?
No, I don't think so. And whether people are tortured in Gitmo is something we're still finding out.
Yes. That's where we leave it. You're right, a big thought saved for last, but one among many over the last half hour or so with Clive James, his new book, Cultural Amnesia, Necessary Memories from History and the Arts. It's published by Norton. You'll be appearing at the New York Public Library tonight. I understand that is sold out, but if people want to go and wait for the no-shows, you can hear more from Clive James, perhaps, at the NYPL main branch tonight. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure, Brian. Thank you very much. I wish I could have been more coherent, but the book is the short version.
And from the NYPL, we go to the NYPD in just a minute, as we now know a lot more about what they did before the Republican National Convention in 2004 with non-law-breaking groups. Stay with us.